Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark.
Hi, I'm Paul.
And in this episode, coronavirus, yes, a brief mention, but let's be responsible is our plea. Plus, the Conscious Ad Network, the decline of TV, Rishi Sunak and the Yorkshire tea kerfuffle, and new campaigns from Uber Eats, Tesco and Three. I guess we can't not talk about coronavirus. You probably know that we record this show a few days in advance of it going out. So who knows where it will be by the time this emerges. I think Paul and I have been talking about it as, you know, working in the creative industry and also being employers. And we came up with a few things that we thought that we should all think about. There are just those three things, and they're all united by one word: responsible. So let's be responsible in our response to the coronavirus. As an employer, we talked about we should be ready to operate with flexible working in the most Catholic sense of that word. Flexible doesn't just mean working at home, it means working in new creative innovative ways so that we can continue to do what we do.
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of actually a good friend of mine, she is a very senior figure in HR, chatting to her last night, and it's kind of, she kind of had all these policies and documents in place, and now it's like, okay, it's playing out now, and kind of very very busy naturally, as you'd expect, with kind of communication levels, and as you said, the flexible working is a big part of it, and where people can be.
And responsibility as a theme continues in our creativity, and I just want to say to all my mates and matettes out there, if you're working on anything that is coronavirus related, then be responsible and make careful use of language so that we don't cause unnecessary panic. It's just going to be so easy to kind of get this out of proportion, isn't it?
Can we deliver that message to the British media, please?
We'll do our best with our humble listener.
Yes.
And I'm an at-risk group because I'm a diabetic, and I don't know how scared I should be or what I can do. I mean, my husband is filling me with vitamins every day. I mean, he seriously is. I think I'm taking far too much vitamin C at the moment, but
precautionary is good. It's kind of that's you behaving as you want. It's the kind of seeing another hazmat suit image with a big 5,000 number or whatever number next to it. It's kind of, yes, it'll sell papers, but it's not what the public needs.
And do you know what? That brings me on to the third point in terms of responsibility. And for those of us who work in any kind of sales environment, we must not be seen to be doing anything that is profiting from this. I mean, because we've already noticed that. I think you told me a story about Amazon taking down products that are seen to be profiting from it as well.
No, not me, but that's interesting. Talking of sales, just an anecdote I've had about how things are going. A friend of the agency, his wife works for Burberry, and I think 40% of their sales was a China, and when the first sort of main outbreak, their sales naturally absolutely plummeted. But now, are sort of however many weeks or months on, their sales have actually stabilised and re-established to where they were.
Nice bit of good news.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess just to recap, those three things: let's be responsible, an employer, put the well-being of your colleagues first, let's really embrace flexible working, as a creative, careful use of language, don't cause unnecessary panic, and as marketers, as salespeople, let's not profit from this in any way, shape or form. So if coronavirus for us marketers is about responsibility, let's keep talking about responsibility, because in the last episode we spoke about Caroline Flack, and we said there must be a way for brands to get some guidance on how to navigate their way through this really tough area of making sure that I am not funding questionable content. I'm not saying as far as hate, it's questionable content.
Yeah.
And being really aware of where your ads are appearing. And if there weren't any brand lines, we said, hey, we should do it. And stupidly, I couldn't remember when we were recording, there is an organization that is really actually making great inroads in this space. It's a not-for-profit organization. Everybody involved does it just for the real passion of it. It's called the Conscious Advertising Network. And I spoke to its co-chair, Jake Dubbins. And I asked Jake if brands were now more aware of where their advertising is appearing.
I would say that they are waking up to it.
and probably relatively quickly. Having been to this year's both the Advertising Association and ISBAR conference, there's a marked change in tone from the year before, and I think that brands are waking up to their responsibilities, both in terms of, you know, how they advertise, but also what they are funding. And we talk a lot about moving on from brand safety to human safety. And I think that, you know, the humans in charge of these brands don't want to be funding, you know, things that are hugely negative, whether that be bullying of a TV presenter or indeed hate speech or, you know, fake news and the rest. I think we've been a bit too quick to leave it all to the machines and machine learning to take over the targeting decisions for us. And we've been a bit slow to recognize that by doing that, there's a very, very long tail in programmatic advertising. So therefore, your advertising can be appearing, you know, not only on sites that you don't want to be associated with, but, you know, are these ads being seen? Are they viewable? I mean, there's a commercial aspect to this as well, you know. So I think the very first step is to really start that conversation with your agency partners to say, okay, well, I now want to start knowing where these ads are and what are there for, you know, what am I associated with and therefore what am I funding? I think the industry's done a very good job of almost sort of confusing the picture and sort of saying, well, actually, we can't show you everything and it's a bit complicated and so on. But, you know, and also we're reliant on technology to be able to show us those ads. But, you know, I don't think it's good enough now to be able to just say, oh, well, it's just appeared to your target audience across thousands of websites and haven't we done a great job? I think now there's got to be robust and rigor in those placements and audit. There is technology now coming in where you can, you know, live look at where your ads are. I can give you a sort of example from Media Bounty, for example, where we found through using a technology partner that 14% of a budget was going on .pl, so Polish websites. Now, those websites aren't necessarily, you know, they're not harmful, but they certainly weren't the brief. So yeah. Therefore, there's a commercial. It's both a brand and human safety aspect, but there's a commercial aspect to know where your advertising is going.
So, tell me a bit about the Conscious Advertising Network, because this is, you came up in conversation, and I'm sure this is one positive thing that I, as a brand owner, can do to take steps to make sure that I am not funding questionable content.
Yeah. So, the Conscious Advertising Network is an entirely volunteer organisation. It's now, I think, over 80 different businesses that are, our stated aim is to help the ethics catch up with the technology of modern advertising. And sort of really, again, driving that point home that effectively advertising funds the internet. So it funds the good and the bad, and it funds things like Google Maps, it funds, you know, social media, whether or not you think that's good or bad. But it also funds all of the content out there as well. So, you know, we came together to really shine a light on that and to try and encourage the whole industry to take responsibility for shaping, you know, effectively the internet, which obviously reflects and shapes society as well. So we've been pretty, you know, we've drawn from expertise across the industry, you know, people like Creative Equals, people like GSK or Jerry Dakin, for example, have been, from GSK, have been putting together, you know, the D&I manifesto. We've got input from the United Nations, Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights on the hate speech manifesto. So it's really across industry, and civil society, coming together to put together manifestos that brands can sign up to and therefore implement rigor and into their supply chain.
I can imagine there's lots of people listening who'd like to sign up. What does it mean? Well, what am I signing up for? Well, what do I expect I should have to do differently once I become part of the Conscious Advertising Network?
So what we try to do is make it as easy as possible. And there's certainly brands have been initially a little bit worried about, oh my goodness, well, have I got to be perfect? What happens if I sign up and tomorrow I get caught for appearing next to something awful? So, you know, we talk a lot about it being a journey and a collective responsibility that brands and agencies can take together to start, you know, those proper conversations about where what my ads are funding. We've open sourced everything. So there is it's not really an audit document. It's more of a document that gives a sense check of where you are as an advertiser and as your agencies are against each of the six manifestos. And then we've just released, again, an open source training deck or presentation that any, you know, brand or agency can use to train their people, both client and agency side. So it's pretty simple to do. Nobody's expecting everybody to be perfect, but what we do ask is 6 months after signing up, we ask a few questions, which are, you know, how many people have you trained? Our central ask is putting principles of the manifestos into agency briefs. So how many briefs or RFPs contain the principles, and has it made a significant difference to the ethics of your advertising ecosystem?
That's Jake Dobbins, who in his day job is Managing Director of Media Bounty. And he was speaking there as co-founder and co-chair of the Conscious Advertising Network. And you can find out more about them at www.consciousadnetwork.com. Surely one of the old chestnuts of the advertising world is TV dead or is it not?
And both angles have been covered in great length, yeah.
And surely the debate continues simply because the most strident voices of each of those opinions just has an awful lot of money. So the pro-TV lobby, as embodied by Thinkbox, spend a lot of time and money saying TV isn't dead. Mm. And, of course, the Google-owned lobby keeps going, well, it might be.
Yeah.
And it's interesting when somebody independent gives you a point of view. And a couple of weeks ago, Ubiquiti, the monitoring, that's what they're known for as far as I'm concerned, brand, published a report called The Coverage Gap.
Yeah.
Or rather, Mind the Gap, the report was called. It's free to download. You can get your own copy. It's not long to read. And the main point it's making is that that's what's emerging. There is a coverage gap. And I'm not an expert on TV measurement, but the main statistic is called the share of commercial impacts, which I've learned.
The SOCI.
The SOCI, which is one impact is where one ad is seen by one person once. And they're saying that SOCI figure will have declined by 21% over the next 5 years. So, you know, eyeballs seeing ads is dropping in terms of TV advertising. But did you see the other stat about young people?
The kind of the classic hard to reach 18 to 24 year old. Yeah. So was it kind of
half of 18 to 24 year olds won't be watching that TV that we talked about, TV that is advertising, in 5 years' time.
Yeah.
And the assumption is that they're going online, and then the report goes on to talk about, their words, the quality of engagement. So whilst the eyeballs might have shifted to YouTube and the like, the attention that you're getting on YouTube and the like is not the same as the attention that you were getting on TV. So that kind of complex melting pot is what Ubiquiti are referring to as the coverage gap.
And it's a very important conversation to have, because you can imagine the conversation being, well, yes, they're going to YouTube, let's just funnel a percentage of our investment across to there. But then that conversation has to be followed by, as you said, the quality and the value is not going to be the same, because it's going to be skippable, it's going to be probably a lot shorter, and just a digital ad is less welcome than a kind of a TV ad. That's just the fact. But yeah, it's an interesting report from Ubiquiti that yes, they're quite independent, but they've actually historically kind of been pretty pro TV, I suppose, if you were to choose a side of the fence. But I think they had a similar report last year. They've now this year come out and said, actually, it's worse than we thought. in the eyes of the beholder, it's further along than we thought. But yeah, it poses an interesting debate and a conversation we will have to have ourselves, really, in terms of where should investment go. And this is in no way that TV investment is going to change anytime soon. But I think looking at the younger audiences, certainly for brands that are in that space, that is a significant figure. Like the first one around the reduction of kind of impact, fine, but half of younger audiences not being available in theory on TV is something that we need to act on. So yeah, it poses a kind of what do we do about it? I think we'll see more, like we've debated with the likes of Love Island, like less about the show content, but a kind of unicorn, if you will, of TV shows that is kind of like does still get people tuning into linear TV. You saw the scale of commercial structures they had around that sort of show. I think we'll see more of that, whereas those are kind of those traditional TV media plans where you're kind of here, there and everywhere in different spots. There'd be probably more of a doubling down in a particular show that they know they've got confidence in. So like Love Island had... They had bumper sponsors. They had
water bottles. That's my favourite.
They had products in it. They had hair sponsors. They had exclusive online content sponsors. So I expect to see more of that, I would have thought. And then the second thing for me is actually like fuse more qualitative research with the kind of quantitative facts that we're getting around media consumption. So we've got a kind of better understanding of, right, I know this is my audience. I've got a very clear view of who they are. From the media owners, I'm understanding this is where they're moving and where it is, but I would always encourage that we had a qualitative layer to it, and we're finding that ourselves for many reasons by doing even the most basic of qual groups. The scale can of course vary, but I think the fusion of both of those will give people more confidence with the shift and the fragmentation that's coming.
And Ubiquiti's own advice I think is quite useful, and I'm going to repeat it if you don't mind. If you're a brand owner and you're looking forward in 5 years' time, your audience is going to be changing, definitely, and you can count less on the effectiveness of TV in terms of mass reach. So start measuring now in a much more granular way to notice the changes that actually will be adding up to quite a significant change over 5 years. So that if your brand in particular is being affected disproportionately, then you should be taking action soon. And music to our ears, because here at Wax On, we are passionate about content and context together. And what Ubiquiti say is make sure you have the right creative for the right channel or platform. Don't just get one creative idea and expect to repurpose it willy-nilly into every channel. And as you were suggesting, Paul, as well, use structured testing to work out which channels are right for you as well, so that as you explore them, you will get maximum benefit from them to fill the coverage gap for you. A week or so ago, when the Chancellor Rishi Sunak was busy preparing his first budget and to show just how hard he and his team were working, he tweeted from @RishiSunak a photo of him in the Treasury kitchen making cups of tea for everyone. And he was standing alongside an enormous catering pack of Yorkshire tea. In fact, we have the same catering pack in our kitchen. I remember it contains 1,080 bags of tea. And alongside his tweet was the caption, "Quick budget prep break, making tea for the team. Nothing like a good Yorkshire brew." And I think what he was trying to do was he was trying to say, hey, look, you know, I'm the new chancellor in town and I'm down with the kids. I've rolled my sleeves up and I'm making a cup of tea for everybody in the Treasury. And I think he was also trying to give a shout out to his Richmond constituency, which is in Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. And of course, where Yorkshire tea is based. Well, he's certainly not a Yorkshire lad, because I did read up about him, and he was born in Southampton, and then he went on to study PPE at Oxford, and not content with that, he went on to do an MBA at Stanford. So he's not a Yorkshire lad. But I don't know whether you saw this, but his tweet went on to backfire, with the Twitter sphere labelling Yorkshire tea as Tory tea, and some people were then demanding that you boycott the Tory tea because of Rishi's unwitting endorsement. And it made me wonder what happens when you are in that really weird place where a celebrity, let's call him a celebrity, unwittingly gives you endorsement that you probably actually didn't want. So I spoke to Matt Phillips, whose startup agency PPR now advises marketing services companies. But in a previous life, he spent 15 years in corporate comms in the music industry and at the BBC. So he's lived through his own fair share of PR crises. I asked Matt, what would he have done in this situation?
I think the first point, I suppose, is to have a good mitigation plan in place for whenever there is a crisis. And we can get on to whether this was a real crisis in a minute. But when you have a crisis, the first thing is, and there's a lot of speculation running, you need to close it down with a statement and issue the and you play on the facts. And in this case, they knew that the fact straight away, which is this was not an official campaign and an official endorsement, and they need to issue a statement quickly and get out there on the front foot, which they did brilliantly, actually, and they were quite quick to do that. Secondly, they needed to issue that rebuttal in a way that wasn't po-faced and inconsistent with the tone of voice that they have generally on the feed, which again, it was a little bit flippant and playful. It was, you know, we wouldn't start a Twitter storm on a Friday, as if, and that was probably the right response. But what they seem to have adopted tactically is this sort of clap back strategy, where you sort of poke the trolls with a view to creating a reaction, and the witty put downs can generate quite a strong reaction. And I suppose if the objective of the campaign is to drive engagement and put fuel on the fire and get people talking about it, because the put down was so witty and clever, they did that very, very successfully. However, is that the right target? Is that the objective? Is that the right tone of the voice from the brand? And for me, I'm not entirely sure, putting a corporate comms hat on, is whether you want to be doing that. I suppose that's the second point. And then the third point is the sort of the follow-up after the event, when they gave what has been sort of credited as being quite an emotional and human and brave response, which is all well and good. But ultimately, the response, I felt, was a bit too emotional, especially having come out of a Twitter storm that they in part created. So I think they're in a little bit of thin ice. So on balance, I think they probably got away with it. But I think from a corporate comms and reputation perspective, is this coverage that has resulted the best reflection of our brand in the press? I'm not sure.
It leads me on to ask you questions, as I thought I'd use my time to learn a bit about working with celebrities. There must be strengths and weaknesses in working with a celeb, you know, when they go off brief and all kinds of things. Have you got any guidance for us in terms of working with celebs?
Well, rather like children and animals, it can be wild and dangerous. And you reminded me of a moment earlier in my career when I was talking about music file sharing and why this was a bad thing. There's a clip of me saying, so the music piracy is really bad because blah de blah de blah. And the next clip was Robbie Williams stood outside a trade event going, piracy's great. And obviously the juxtaposition undermined me somewhat.
Why did he say that?
I think he was having a bit of fun. Bit of a laugh. But the point is that a lot of celebrities are, you know, they're their own people. They have their own audience and they have their own personal brand. And, you know, if your objective is to ride their way, their success. So if your objective is effectively saying our brand profile is relatively low, that celebrity has a high brand profile, let's put that celebrity on and we can ride their brand. It's a bridging thing. And it helps associate the positive attributes that you associate with the celebrity are kind of transferred upon your brand by association. That's sort of the point. It's a shortcut for consumers to go, oh, David Beckham sponsors that watch. I like that watch. And it's a subliminal thing that can be very, very effective. But when you're working with celebrities and to a lesser extent social media influencers as well, which is a whole other kettle of fish, you lack that control, and you might not necessarily know kind of who they are, what they think, what they feel, and their values may not be aligned with your values as a brand. So I guess the key point is do your homework if you are picking an ambassador for your brand to make sure that their values align. And I would say think values ahead of reach in terms of their audience, because the celebrity will be just as quick to burn you if they feel that your brand is inconsistent. It reminds me actually of when I think it was Kylie Jenner who criticised Snapchat after their redesign and said, oh, I'm so over Snapchat. I mean, their share price went down by 10%
because
of that negative association. So while her using Snapchat and posting on it as an unofficial ambassador was very positive in the ups, it can really affect you with the downs as well. So you've got to be careful as a brand not to tether yourself too closely to any one individual, have an exit strategy. You almost kind of need a prenup.
That's a really good point.
Kind of like in the event it all goes wrong, in the same way you would as a shareholders agreement, you need to go through the due diligence of, you know, if this goes wrong, what things are they going to say that would need mean we need to cut our ties? And this is the kind of thing that you need to think about really carefully. Talk to red top journalists, take the advice of a very strong consumer PR agency, because they know, you know, behind closed doors, who's a wrong one and who's not, despite what is said in the press.
Because they're sitting on all those dirty stories that they've still not released yet.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they've got that safe in the office of stuff that you don't want to, you know. So, while that's not my area of specialism, I would definitely get professionals who really know that world when you're thinking about celebrity endorsements. But I think your starting point should always be on your own back. Try and build the brand by what it does for people rather than trying to ride the ambassadorial skills of someone else. But if there's someone who genuinely has a really good fit for the brand and is generally aligned with the cause or the purpose or the why of your brand is aligned with the why of that individual, then that's a great fit. And you will go rise together with the ups and downs and think about the long-term partnership rather than the short-term wins.
And even better, if you have the insight that the celebrity is a customer. I was talking to a brand yesterday, and you will never guess who. And they said, Alec Baldwin and his family are customers of ours. You know, they can't do anything about that, but that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, certainly. I mean, provided you have a relationship with a positive customer who loves your brand, that's different from being an ambassador.
Yeah.
And I think if a lot of the community managers on social media are kind of giving love to their best and biggest fans, you know, you see it happen in music and fan clubs and all of that, that passion for the brand that is shared by someone who's high profile, then that's absolutely great. But you just don't tether yourself too closely to that.
That's Matt Phillips, founder of PPR, telling us how he might have managed the Yorkshire Tea Rishi Sunak social media kerfuffle.
Everybody's bringing it in life to a certain extent.
Do I bring it?
Absolutely.
Georgie, brilliant.
Uber Eats?
Bring it.
Bring what, you might ask? Well, I'm bringing food, obviously, but you can bring anything. It's about bringing the energy.
Baby,
it's about bringing a vibe.
Something magical going on in here.
It's about bringing good times.
Thank you.
What are you bringing, Doreen?
Just the washing.
I mean, she's still bringing it.
Now it's time to look at some work. And, you know, Paul, I worry that sometimes we are in a bit of a bubble and we forget to talk about work that's actually out there. Not work that our mates have done or work that somebody's tweeted about, but work that's actually on the telly, on posters, and that everybody has seen. And the first campaign is that one. It is everywhere, and I think it is brilliant, and it's for Uber Eats.
This is Guz Khan playing the role of a Uber Eats delivery guy, but he's basically introducing their new platform, which is called Bring It, which I actually quite like. You know, kind of, I didn't get it when I first saw it, didn't quite pick it up, but this platform around, obviously, delivery drivers bring their food, but how can people in their lives bring it in the modern sense of the word?
Showing up.
Yeah, exactly. Like, whether it's professionally or kind of in your personal life. And the ads are done very well. It's done by Mother, and it's a very good Mother ad, as you'd expect from them. Different kind of...
scenarios, the office worker,
scenario execution,
the overtired parents.
Yeah.
And I picked it because I just want to do a bit of textbooky GCSE advertising stuff on it, because I think it is a brilliant insight that, you know, positivity, showing up, my version of Bring It, you know, is missing in our lives. And when somebody does that, it has such a profound impact on you. So great strategic insight imbued in the brand. And then from a kind of creative point of view, to bring talent on board, and 99% sure, but I don't know, that he has had a very heavy hand in a great way in the creation and finalization of those scripts and the way it was done, because his comedic personality is definitely coming through. Mm-hmm. And what he has done is he has acted in the most powerfully believable way, that guy.
Yeah.
That amazing guy who does a simple job, but he does it with such conviction and such positivity that he makes everybody he comes into contact with smile.
He brings it.
He brings it. And I want to do a show about the guy on the underground who is always so super positive when he tells you what is going on the line. And there's another one who sings. And we could do an entire show about the positive voices from TFL. If you're listening, let's do it.
You're bringing it. Parents of the year, you know.
So a week or so ago, there was lots of social media chatter about what it sounded like was the first time a supermarket had sold any plasters, and I mean plasters that you stick on yourself when you've stabbed yourself. The first time a supermarket was selling plasters that were not white. And loads of people went, wow, what a great idea. It's so shameful this hasn't happened before. The supermarket is Tesco. BBH followed it up with some ads, and everybody loved the ads. Once we'd loved the plasters, we then loved the ads. What did you think to it?
It literally played out over a week, didn't it?
Yeah.
From kind of... Tesco's got the huge PR story. The ads came out, which again, as you said, everyone liked. And then as you got to the back end of the week in question, some questions were raised in terms of, are Tesco's the first?
Definitely, I mean, not the first.
Just take a step back. Yeah, I mean, it is staggering that it is really on a mass scale only just happening. I know it's makeup and underwear that it's starting to, but still, great that it finally is. And so that's the interesting part of this, is that actually there's many other brands out there that have been doing it but have not quite had the voice or the soapbox that Tesco's have had, which is Tesco's have completely got this huge brand salience off the back of a story that isn't actually theirs.
If this is true, allegedly a small BAME owned business did come up with the idea of doing non-white plasters some time ago, went in and pitched it to Tesco, and then Tesco ignored it, allegedly then just went on and did it themselves, which if that is true is very sad.
Yeah. Disco. So, last but not least, in our creative campaign review is Three, and their new ad for The Real 5G Future Is Here. One of many ads at the moment which are promoting 5G. EE comes to mind with, as I call him, Richard Bacon, but actually Kevin Bacon. So we thought it was good timing to talk about those that are getting behind the 5G revolution. We'll come back to what that actually means. But yeah, this is an advert from Wieden & Kennedy. I've seen the 3-minute version. I've seen a couple of the cut downs live. 3-minute naturally is the best representation, I think, of the creative concept. The cut downs don't work as well, quite simply. But the longer version, which I have seen, is, in my opinion, creatively great. Really enjoyed it. On the theme of brand salience and being distinctive in your creative, I felt that was the case. I left positively from a very creative perspective. But it's definitely one to debate because it sounds very different from EE in terms of presenting benefits, which I know you were quite keen to talk about.
It was such a jumble of cliched future scenarios. I thought, well, it doesn't mean anything to me right now. I think they have missed a trick by not trying to create their own unique associations with it. And the other one I'll throw in for free three is, why didn't you change your name to 5-3?
Hey, UK. You okay, hun? Hold on to your crumpets. Three is building the UK's fastest 5G network. Next stop, the future.
Well, that's about it for this episode. Did you notice? Just two of us.
I know. It felt very, very lonely in
We've
here.
Been abandoned. Ben is in Australia. Hi, Ben. Hope you're listening.
G'day.
And of course, we're a creative agency. Karen's on a shoot.
Yes. But the show must go on, as they say.
Karen's right now probably having the most amazing gourmet food from the food wagon. It'll be the biggest item on the budget for the shoot, won't it? The food.
Maybe.
We'll see you next episode.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.